Hello again, everyone. I'm Dawn Thistle, and I am the Vice Chair of the NERCOMP 2013 Program Committee. It's been such a joy to participate in this program, and I'm thrilled to see you all here. So how has the conference been? What do you think? Good? Excellent. To those of you who have been here from the beginning, welcome back today, and welcome to our online audience. And today is going to be just as stellar as yesterday was. I'd first like to thank the sponsor of today's general session, which is TMS, Tuition Management Systems. You all have a brochure on your chair, and they have a table out in the registration lobby. So please do stop by and thank them for sponsoring this particular session. How many of you have already filled out your vendor card and have 15 stamps on it? Anybody? Oh, a couple of you. Good. If you haven't done it yet, make sure you visit all the vendor stations during the exhibit hall after this session. If you get 15 stamps, you can be entered into a drawing for free registrations for NERCOMP 2014. So be sure you get out there and visit our 59 different vendors and get your 15 stamps. But remember, the drawing is this afternoon at 1:30 during the refreshment break, and you have to be present to win. So now is my opportunity once again to thank everyone for their contributions. We do this both mornings, and I think it's really important that we do that. My first thank you is to Cara Bellotta. She is the chair of this program, and you notice she has her tiara. She's the conference queen. But her energy, her thoughtfulness, her thoroughness have been a complete inspiration to me as I think about being chair next year. I want to grow up to be just like her. Thank you, Cara. I'd also like to thank the staff of EDUCAUSE, and they're standing in the back there, Gretchen and Carolyn and Lauren and Victoria. A whole team of people have come from EDUCAUSE, most of them all the way from Colorado, to help us with this conference, and they have been fantastic. We know that if there's anything we forget to do, they'll remember and they'll pick up the slack for us. So they've been great. Thanks, EDUCAUSE. I'd like to thank all of the many NERCOMP volunteers. We thanked the program committee yesterday, but you've seen us all in our red t-shirts. They've been fantastic at greeting, at organizing the NERCOMP Central, at convening sessions, and certainly overseeing the selection process for the sessions that you're attending today. So they've been great. So we'd like to thank the program committee and also the NERCOMP board. Always supportive, always moving NERCOMP in new directions that we can all enjoy. I also would like to thank the presenters. I don't think we always do that, but the presenters are the ones who really make this conference, who submit the proposals. How many of you have gone to a presentation and thought to yourself, wow, we're doing that? I could have talked about that, or gee, we did that, but we did it a little differently, and maybe somebody would have liked to hear what we were doing. How many of you have thought that when you went to a presentation? Yes, okay. So, thinking about Frank Barrett's presentation yesterday, you have to be brave. You have to put yourself out there. You have to be able to improvise and submit that proposal. So as conference chair for next year, I'm really encouraging you to think about that now and get your proposal submitted, because what's the worst that can happen? You might not get accepted, but you might give us a fantastic presentation. So please, that's my shameless plug for next year's program. Submit your proposals. And finally, I want to thank all of you for your attendance and your support of NERCOMP. Without you, without our members, we wouldn't be here, and you make it such a vibrant organization. It's a pleasure to be part of NERCOMP. So everyone, enjoy the rest of the conference, and now I'd like to call Queen Cara to the podium to introduce this morning's speaker.
So I've changed my mind. It's not pretentious to wear a tiara on stage anymore. That was my feeling yesterday. I've changed my mind. So it's my pleasure to introduce one of the country's leading innovators in higher education, Elizabeth Coleman, who is the 9th president of Bennington College. She's been there since 1987. Her vision for the liberal arts and their role in the reinvigoration in society has been widely recognized, and she's spoken internationally, including the 25th anniversary TED Ideas Worth Spreading conference. Prior to assuming the presidency at Bennington, President Coleman was the Dean of College of Arts and Sciences at the New School for Social Research in New York, where she founded and directed the school's first ventures in undergraduate education. A scholar of Shakespeare and Henry James, President Coleman graduated with honors from University of Chicago and received her PhD with distinction from Columbia University. Please join me in welcoming President Coleman to the stage.
I'm not sure how you thank a queen, so I'll just say thanks a ton, Dawn and Kara, and both of you for inviting me here today. Good morning. There we go. So God willing, this thing is going to do what it's supposed to do, and this will do what it's supposed to do. So let's begin with the rhetoric. It has become commonplace in the halls of academia and elsewhere to extol the virtues of innovation and those of improvisation, presumably because it is associated somehow with innovation, and a presumption that both are inextricably connected to technology. Taken together, they have come to constitute a kind of holy trinity, each basking in the reflected glow of the other, expressed with an order of unquestioning faith more reminiscent of a catechism than anything resembling a wrestling with ideas. No matter what the problem, however huge, however intransigent, however complex, however important, or actually, for that matter, unimportant, it is virtually certain that early on, someone will insert technology into the conversation as the answer, followed by an equally inevitable chorus of assent. The rather substantial amounts of evidence that suggest the outlandishness of this presumption are blithely ignored. Indeed, doubt, uncertainty, thinking altogether, is typically treated as a sign of an uncool Luddite myopia, revealing an incapacity to appreciate the power of digital technology first to transform the world and then to save it. We are in the face of a phenomena that is probably most aptly described as technological fundamentalism. Examples of this orientation abound. Theories that follow are typical of scores of others that appear with increasing frequency in scholarly journals, popular media, and everything in between. Whatever their differences, what is most striking is the extent to which they are the same. So here's the first of two. Elite institutions, those highly selective institutions with the most restrictive admissions criteria, would be well served to consider the means for imparting more broadly and more cost-effectively the sum and substance of what we teach. Technology has the power to be the conductor of this education and to empower the masses of people rather than just a privileged few at elite institutions. And by this, I am referring to more comprehensive efforts than merely open source education and free access lectures. How can elite institutions with the brightest minds and the most ambitious programs flatten the curve to make this quality education readily available to a much broader segment of our society? This is a vexing and ambitious project, but it is a task made more possible every day through the innovations of software and technology. It is, in my view, a challenge that elite educational institutions must take on. Of course, I am sufficiently humble to understand that the musings of a college president do not affect change. That's not this college president. Nothing happens at a college or university unless faculty and others in the campus community decide that there is something to an idea and take the initiative. But I think the future is clear, and we will be looking in our rearview mirror if we are not prepared to grapple with these new opportunities. The educational transformation that we face demands that we have the confidence to explore these new opportunities. In effect, in addition to the claims for the vast transforming power of technology, the emphasis on methods of delivery, the ubiquitous reference to technology's gift of innovation, there are certain characteristic patterns that emerge which become clearer if we look a little more closely. Most important is a remarkable complacency with respect to fundamental purposes, the reference to the work, of course, that we are doing, and the challenge being, of course, only to extend that. The things that one might presume really matter when talking about sweeping educational reform, the content, quality, nature, and purposes of education present no challenges whatsoever. Apparently, we have those down cold. Indeed, the whole point is that within the walls of those highly selective institutions, the education is so perfect, so superb, that the only thing warranting our attention, prompting our creative imagination, requiring our leadership, is to figure out how as many people as possible can benefit from the perfection of what we order, of what we offer. The exclusive focus on methods of delivery, the magnitude of the complacency about what is being delivered, makes the subsequent heightened language vis-a-vis the enormity of the challenge and the demands it makes on leadership strange, to put it mildly. Given the fact that the faculty is being told that what they are currently doing is the embodiment of perfection, it's hard to take seriously that we are in territory where leadership, much less an especially demanding order of leadership, is an issue. Calling this an educational transformation is a formidable test of the capacity to make something so by saying it is so. As for the choice of humble under these circumstances, probably the less said, the better. One other example. Let me get this right here. Well, that's fine. Different setting, otherwise, as you'll see, the same. So first, the claims for technology. Technology has changed the way we live. It must also change the way we learn. Then, the emphasis on methods of delivery. In this case, by placing the focus of technology on technology's role in reimagining the classroom. Next, that same heightened language about high-stakes challenges, its demands, the incantatory references to innovation, and again reminding us of the perils of academic politics, the rigidities of the academy. I want to go back to the previous slide for a second. Technology may have changed the way we live and the way we learn, and we are in the presence of nothing less than wild experimentation. But once again, there's no suggestion that what we are learning needs any reconsideration. It would seem that being engaged, empowered, inspired, and challenged is a matter of how, not what, we experience. More precisely, whether or not we are using a mobile device, a podcast, and blogs. Next, the same heightened language about high-stakes challenges, its demands, the incantatory references to innovation, and again reminding us of the perils of academic politics, the rigidities of the academy. And again, all rests on the broad shoulders of technology to carry the day. Nor are we spared the stirring call to arms. What role will you play? Will you cling to the safety and comfort of the traditional educational models that have defined United States schools for more than a century? Or will you help drive the innovation to ensure that our young people are prepared not only to compete, but to lead in an increasingly digital world? Try to imagine for a moment what would happen to this resounding prose if technology was taken out of the mix? It's quite an extraordinary role. The weight that it is asked to carry is best captured in an article that anatomizes the current state of education. Number 7, entitled Technology Rules, tells us, changes in technology defined how we deliver an education. They define us as educators and administrators, and they define our students, even down to how they think and how they process learning. Our students have grown up with Facebook, the internet, and personal technology devices. They are more comfortable reading a book online than they are reading a paper copy of a textbook. They have very different views on communication and on what they want to communicate about to and from. Again, this is characteristic of the, quote, new normal. That's it. That's what we are. That's what our students are. Facebook. What we are holding in our hands when we read. This extraordinary trivialization of what it is to be human, whether the moment we were referring to is new or old, is hard to take seriously. But alas, it is. One is tempted to say deadly serious. Albeit an extreme form of the underlying exorbitant treatment of technology, what I have referred to as a form of fundamentalism has in fact shown an astounding endurance. It is now decades since we first had the transformative powers of the new technologies drummed into us. Indeed, one of the more astonishing aspects of this phenomena is the extent to which no one seems at all fazed by the fact that these claims about the vast power of technology and the promise of harnessing that power to lead transforming innovative change have been repeated virtually verbatim for decades. I might add that this unchanging and ceaseless repetition doesn't make it any easier to suffer being instructed ad nauseum by technology enthusiasts that we must be mindful of how rapidly things change. And it was at least 40 years ago that the leading philanthropic foundations announced that the only proposals to be given serious consideration would embrace the new technologies. These technologies were to be the source and the only source of transforming possibilities. The magnitude of that short-sightedness is not only in the limitations of what this focus on technology as a force in and of itself could possibly produce, But even more tragically, the many ideas that were not pursued, never even imagined. Far more than the exaggeration, oversimplification, what we are in fact witnessing is a shutting down of our imaginative, intellectual, and ethical resourcefulness that has accompanied this mind-numbing liturgy about the powers of technology and the gift of innovation that it presumably carries in its wake. It would be hard to fathom, were it not for the role that technology has been assigned on this world stage. Together with innovation and improvisation, it is both the means and the ends, the alpha and the omega. Technology needs no justification beyond itself. On the contrary, it is the source of all that matters. It is the producer, director, and star. Technology, more precisely, our mindless adoration of technology, then very conveniently serves to close these emperors, or wizards, as in Oz, who claim to be bringing us brave new worlds. And the price of this gift is high. Those purposes that can be most readily achieved through the mechanisms of technology dominate the scene. Anything else has difficulty being heard. Purposes are radically diminished. Innovation and improvisation are reduced to slogans. There is a startling simplicity to the world that it paints, and one that is actually inimical to what feeds improvisation or innovation. There is no ambiguity, no uncertainty, no confusion, no doubt, no conflict. Complexity is gone. The only limitations are our inadequate appreciation of the powers of technology. Lest you think I exaggerate, this from a widely praised book recently published called Abundance. Humanity is now entering a period of radical transformation in which technology has the potential to significantly raise the basic standards of living for every man, woman, and child on the planet. Within a generation, we will be able to provide goods and services once reserved for the wealthy few to any and all who need them or desire them. The point is this. When seen through the lens of technology, few resources are truly scarce. They're mainly inaccessible. History is littered with tales of once rare resources made plentiful by innovation. The reason is pretty straightforward. Scarcity is often contextual. Imagine a giant orange tree packed with fruit. If I pluck all the oranges from the lower branches, I am effectively out of accessible fruit. From my limited perspective, oranges are now scarce. But once someone invents a piece of technology called a ladder, I've suddenly got new reach. Problem solved. Technology is a resource, liberating mechanism. It can make the scarce the new abundance. It is hard not to rub one's eyes. Is it really possible to ignore the fact that history is also littered with tales of once abundant resources made scarce by innovation? Or to ignore the great limitations of technology under certain circumstances, as in the recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan? Has adoration of technology really reached the point where we presume that the resources it liberates are simply or even likely to be focused on delivering goods and services to any and all who need them? Is it so easy to forget that if you want to see the most remarkable and sustained examples of human ingenuity, creativity, resourcefulness, innovation in the realm of technology, don't go to the Apple Store. Go to the Imperial War Museum in London. Or must we remind ourselves that DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, is by far the most consistent, reliable, and generous supporter of technological innovation? Technology does not operate in a world in which the many ways it can be used are necessarily the ways it is used. Nor is its use driven typically by an interest in innovation. an especially vivid example of the complexities in the role technology actually plays in the world, on the world stage, is in issues relating to guns in this country. Let's see if we can get this. Whoops. Despite the huge role of the internet in facilitating the sale of guns, laws related to gun sales are informed by data more than 20 years out of date because of legal constraints on access to that information. As of 2003, the NRA persuades Congress to impose restrictions on how cities and elected officials can use and share information gathered about guns used in crimes. These Tiert amendments, he was a congressman, also bar the ATF, that's the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, bar TF from using an electronic database to organize its records, forcing the agency charged with enforcing gun laws to use a paper-based filing system. The gun lobby has made repeated attempts to eliminate the ATF's tracking of bulk sales of assault weapons by dealers in the four states at border Mexico, vital part of United States efforts to curb flow of assault weapons to drug rings. In several states, the NRA resists efforts by mayors to require gun owners to report missing or stolen guns, 1.4 million at least, missing from 2005 to 10. In the affordable health plan, there is a provision forbidding federal health programs from collecting or disclosing information about firearm ownership. The internet, for sure, is unconstrained in making access to guns unlimited. Not so when it would serve to gather the information that might provide the oversight to reveal the consequences of this access or serve to limit its abuses. In addition to the absence of complexity, presence of complexity, of complacency that is so typical of the rhetoric, we are invited to think that transformations of possibilities, doing things that might actually make the world a better place, can be accomplished without reference to the essential role of imagination, courage, character, intellect, conviction, doubt, determination, uncertainty, confusion, and most of all, on purposes that are hard fought and deeply considered. I am talking about purposes that are capable of sustaining the very substantial demands of innovation and that require the capacity for the powers of improvisation. But of course, and fortunately, this is far from the whole story. There are other voices that allow us to see innovation and improvisation in much richer and more complex ways. This, from a remarkable book called Don't Shoot, One Man, A Street Fellowship, and the End of Violence in the Inner City by David M. Kennedy. Remarkable because of its texture, its capacity to see and convey what is so rarely captured in the rush of events, its profound modesty, its complexity, its realism, its precision, its clarity. First, he engages or invites us to see how difficult real change is when the stakes, even when the stakes are very high, and some sense of what entrenched actually means. The core idea behind the new policing was that there were fundamentally more effective ways to go after important crime problems. In substance, the details don't matter. It didn't take. American policing was not transformed. Whatever the new idea's potential, it simply was not realized. There were isolated success stories on the street. You could see it really was possible to do things differently. There were a few departments that came pretty close to actually redesigning themselves, but it wasn't enough. Nobody went all the way. Most departments, most of the time, continue to do what they'd always done. drive around in cars, answer 9/11 calls, investigate crimes after they'd already happened. I watched from the sidelines with increasing desperation. Then the critical decision to act, made independent of circumstances, where the unknown remains as great as ever, and the purpose, but the purpose, despite the uncertainty, is so great that it simply cannot be denied. There we go. 10 years after I stood there in Watts, I grew deeply, desperately frustrated, tired of sitting on the sidelines watching, tired of researching and writing, tired of saying what other people should do. I went into the field, not this time as an observer. I wanted to do something. I wanted to help, though I had no real idea how. I found from the very beginning a gifted, dedicated, and still growing band of partners. We've been at it ever since, now for nearly 20 years in cities all across America, and we've gotten somewhere. We are now in the land where improvisation is inevitable. When you don't know what you're doing, that's all you've got. His stunning description of the thing itself. It has not been linear, clear, direct. It has been opaque, confusing, deeply painful. I've seen pieces of a puzzle, thought I saw a hole, found out I was wrong, doubled back, looked elsewhere, found new pieces. I have found myself navigating a landscape littered with preconception, prejudice, myth, misunderstanding, my own not least of all. I have gone from feeling, at least from time to time, pretty damn smart, to feeling deeply, profoundly humble, and not infrequently ashamed. Looking back from where I stand now, I can see that nearly everything important was there to be seen, clearly visible from the beginning. And had I the wit to see it, I didn't. Looking back from where I stand now, I can see how essentially simple the answers are, how basic. I couldn't see it. But we saw something. We did some things. We kept pushing. We saw other things that still led to other things, and we have arrived at a place where we know something important. I suspect that's a description many of you recognize. Finally, what the new was actually made of. It was built from existing tools and powers, put together in a radically new way. Nobody had done anything that they couldn't already do. There was no new law, no new authority, no new funding, no new resources. They had taken their existing capacity, exercised their existing discretion, and created something wholly distinct. One other example from another wonderful book about the history of Manhattan entitled The Island at the Center of the World by Russell Shorto, the description of Hudson's historic voyage reminds us, most especially of the enormous importance in life of what we are after, at least in a life where anything resembling the genuinely innovative is likely to be achieved. It also tells us some other things that can accompany discovery, but let's see. First, we have the maps created by Mercator and Frisius. What these English colleagues found most intriguing about the maps and globes was an area most people would ignore. The top, the Arctic Circle, Frisius's map, oriented as if looking down from the North Star, showed a distinct open channel cutting across the Arctic, which was self-confidently labeled in Latin, freedom trium fratrum. The sight of the boldly indicated strait of the three brothers must have made these English friends gasp, the holy grail for all learned and adventuresome minds was the discovery of a short passage to the riches of Asia. So we begin this historic voyage with what was in fact a comedy of errors and an impossible dream. And it gets even crazier. His, Hudson's, first voyage was pure madness. When geographers debated whether the elusive passage to India lay to the northwest, via Canada or the northeast, round Russia, what Hudson attempted in his first command was something fantastically bolder and far more ridiculous than either of these. Something that no human being had ever tried, to go straight over the top of the world. He was relying on an established theory, first proposed 80 years before by Robert Thorne, a merchant adventurer who argued that in addition to finding the ice melt away as one neared the pole, that the lucky sailor who ventured across the top of the world would benefit from the perpetual clearness of the day without any darkness in the night. Daylight may be handy, but to purposely steer a 70-foot wooden boat manned by a crew of 12 and powered only by wind straight north on a direct course for the top of the world, defying the 6 million square mile Arctic ice shelf, proposing to slice straight across it and come careening down the other side of the planet, the nerve of it beggars the imagination. No wonder that on the morning of April 19, 1607, Hudson and his tiny crew stepped out of the weak spring sunlight, shuffled into the dark ancient interior of the church at St. Ethelburger, just inside Bishopsgate, took their places among the congregations, and beseeched the God of their forefathers to bless their endeavor. I hope it is clear that my quarrel is not with technology, any more than it is with innovation or improvisation. These are rich and fascinating expressions of human effort and human resourcefulness, but they are not panaceas. They are anything but formulaic or available on demand. They are not slogans. And they are not things. They are complex phenomena made of many moving parts and dimensions. Certainty and complacency are more likely to be enemies than friends. The paradox we encounter daily, the quest for innovation as if it were a thing to be intentionally acquired, and as if it were a value in and of itself, independent of circumstances, is as clear a sign as any I can imagine that we are proceeding in a way that is least likely to discover it. And there is indeed a special character to the contemporary technologies that have captivated so many. This technology is not about ladders, splendid as they may be. It promises rather to extend the uses of our mind. That is exhilarating. But that promise of power is not a reason to abandon or trivialize the purposes it's meant to serve. On the contrary, it demands purposes that are especially robust and remarkable. The more powerful the technology, the more it needs and deserves a corresponding depth in the dimensions of the challenge it is being asked to address, if we are to do justice to that power. Excuse me. When, for example, information technology is connected with a pedagogy of discovery, rather than one of consumption, things change. So at Bennington, for example, in the context of a new curricular initiative organized for the purposes of advancing public action, we are embedding librarians in courses. Why? Because being inside the course enhances enormously the librarian's capacity to use their resources to assist us in finding what we need to know and to grasp the extent of what we don't know, which is a continual challenge when you are in a universe where no one has the answers and everyone is responsible for finding them. So where does this leave us? You, of course, know much better than I the challenge of getting beyond the machinery. there are a couple of things worth contemplating. We might seriously consider talking a lot less about technology itself, innovation itself, improvisation itself. To my knowledge, their value has until recently been treated as inseparable from what they do or what they don't do. And that is scarcely because technology and innovation have been unimportant, but that is very different from making them in themselves the object of our attention. Indoor plumbing actually did transform lives, but that somehow did not promote endless talk about sinks and toilets. At the same time, we need to be talking a lot more about what we are trying to do. I am painfully aware that we are living in a time when avoidance of content is a highly developed art, and getting to substance is no easy matter. Our affection for the expression critical thinking is an example. Somehow, putting critical in front of thinking makes it seem as if we are saying something, as if thinking itself weren't the challenge, and as if the quality of our thinking is independent of what we are thinking about. It is worth noting the parallels to the way we use technology. Getting the importance of substance back into the thick of things is a real challenge, but it happens to be one that you are uniquely positioned to address. One of the striking things about your perspective and your craft is your capacity to get us, the users, to be clear about what we are trying to achieve, and it matters. The decision of what we choose to make central is truly critical. One thing is certain. There is no dearth of issues that are rich in substance, urgency, and complexity. During the past decade, we have witnessed escalating crises in the most vital areas of our public life, including a devastating failure of our schools to effectively educate vast numbers of our young, spectacular inequities in the distribution of wealth, an extraordinary timidity in our approach to providing health care, a growing refusal in the corridors of power to even talk about, much less confront, the potential of global warming to upend human civilization itself, an increasing incapacity for government to represent the public interest, a predilection for the uses of force despite overwhelming evidence of its limitations. And at a time when clarity of thought, respect for evidence, appreciation for complexity is especially critical, the sensationalism of the media, the other major educational institution in our society, continues unabated. The distance we have traveled is best measured by reminding ourselves that the Federalist Papers were originally published in three New York newspapers and then, in response to popular demand, published in newspapers throughout the colonies. There is no more damning evidence of the failure of education at all levels in this country than the quality of what we, the public, including our graduates, craves or tolerates in the media. Education has an enormous role to play in this conversation, but that is not going to happen until our idea of pressing problems extends beyond our anxiety about changes that may make our current financial models unsustainable, and that we stop treating technology as a panacea that will transform our situation. You, whose craft and orientation is significantly defined and shaped by this technology, have a critical role to play in that conversation because of your unique understanding of how to parse purposes. What exactly are you trying to accomplish? And even more important, your immersion in and appreciation for the interconnectedness of things. Both are immensely important, and both are sorely lacking. The real forces that shape the work and define the horizons of our faculty and our students are not Facebook, iPads, or even MOOCs. They are the silos that disciplines create and inhabit, the departmental structure that makes the organization of knowledge, in fact, an organization of power. The fragmentation of knowledge that is its inevitable consequence, the absurd overvaluation of an increasingly narrow expertise. This is not a context that is likely to generate an appreciation for the interconnectedness of things. The extent of our current efforts to address the limitations of the silos that the disciplines reside in is not particularly encouraging. That is, to put six silos in a room instead of one. It is literally unimaginable that we could address anything worth talking about in ways that do not start with the categories provided by the disciplines. And that's a big problem. Here's the point. Your orientation is very different and very important. At the very least, it seems to me we all owe it to ourselves, to our work as educators, and to our country, to somehow or other move off the sidelines, to start engaging such questions as, what kind of a world are we making? What kind of a world can we be making? What kind of a world should we be making? Thank you. We haven't talked about questions. I'd be happy to.
If we have time for questions.
Right?
Will a copy of your speech be available?
Yeah.
Where can I get it?
I have no idea, but they probably will be able to answer that. You can write, you can send me a note at ecoleman@bennington.edu, and I'll be delighted to send it to you. Did you get that? It makes sense, actually. ecoleman@bennington.edu. One of the few that do.
Good morning. I'm Ellen Cohen, the director of IT at Holy Cross. Do you have any advice for us as leaders in our roles? You hinted at some of it. Because we're looked at to talk in this kind of talk you gave as the examples early on. They look to us to make it more real because it's all kind of fuzzy. I mean, recently I had a senior vice president say to me, Ellen, what kind of IT director are you? You're arguing against this when we were talking about lecture capture. And I said, well, careful, you might blow our whole pricing model. I mean, who's going to pay the tuition they pay to go to Holy Cross if the faculty member's not there right in front of them? And I was kind of arguing against it. And that was the uncomfortable part about the conversation, is that my role is to talk just like
be the booster. I appreciate that, and one of the things I try to avoid in this is to start telling you guys, so why don't you do this and why don't you do that, because I realize what a complex position you're in. I don't know the answer to that, but there's got to be some way in which you can turn this around and make it work, right? So like that example with the gun guys, what they did was they took it's kind of Zen thing. They took the very forces that they were dealing with, certain of them, and they used them to turn the situation around. So you're in a situation where everybody's saying you're God's gift to the world. Without you, we would be nothing. You're the savior. You're the second, you know. You do know what I'm talking about. And I don't know how you kind of make that work in a different way than this dumb, frankly, kind of often mindless. It makes no sense financially, often what people are talking about. I mean, it's just a kind of a juggernaut of sorts. But I am certain of one thing. It won't happen when you try to do it alone. It would be something where a bunch of you would sit down and really start thinking about, all right, is there a way we can begin to do something that would change the dynamic in some way. And I suspect there is, but I don't know what it is. And I'm not trying to avoid the question. I'm really not. I really don't know.
That's a tough question, I realize.
Yeah, and I think, well, I think you have to know. You know what I mean? I mean, it has to come out of you. And you might find some sympathy, you know, you might extend the conversation. It doesn't only have to be people in technology. One way I am suggesting is have something worth doing that you're talking about, something really important. High stakes are very important to engage people in powerful thinking. Why would you want to change it? And you have to get out of the boundaries, as I suggested, of everything being talked about in terms of how are we doing? What's this doing for us? Gotta be.
Thank you.
Any other easy question?
Good morning. I'm Lisa Trubit from the University at Albany, and I thought I'd play off of Ellen's question a little bit and see if maybe we could get a little more of your perspective as a leader to us as the technology folks. You talked a lot in your discussion about silos, and that's a term that I think many of us are familiar with, because in IT we often feel like we're siloed in our individual roles. And speaking now only for myself, sometimes I feel like the issue that we have with the rest of the campus is our ability to get out of our own silo and maybe get into yours. Yep. And so I'm wondering if maybe you can help us think about ways that we can go to leadership on our own campuses and work together so we can better engage in that conversation, because I'm a little afraid when we stay in our own silos, we sort of do this.
Absolutely. I mean, again, one of the things about the gun story, which, by the way, it's an amazing book, you should buy it, it's really quite remarkable, is it was about how people started working together. Fundamentally, that's what happened. All kinds of agencies started somehow connecting. A couple of ideas. So there are a couple of to me, divisions that, by the way, exist at Bennington that make no sense in technology, although we are actually beginning to, you know, push a little. One is between academic and administrative computing. It's ludicrous. What does it do? It creates necessarily competing sources of, you know, you're competing for resources. That's what you're forced to do. So not only are you not working together, you're trying to get your fair share of the pie. The other even more insidious one is the division between the work of teaching and educating and your work. You are serving it, but you, of course, shouldn't be doing it. So they may hire a computer or somebody or other to teach, but they wouldn't, I mean, to look around at the cadre of people. So one thing is, so what do you do about that? Well, you can make arguments for why separating administrative and academic computing makes no sense. Now, there will be a lot of issues because entrenched issues have developed, all kinds of things have happened. Sure. So what means really putting the sweat and thinking about it and talking with each other. The other divide is even more fascinating. How do you begin to start expressing the ways in which you are thinking about things where conversations should be going on between you and students? It's just true. So how to kind of begin to do that? One of the things about the work I'm talking about is for certain you can't do it alone. You then have to extend that. Do you notice that the first thing the guy found was other great people? That's the first thing that happened to him? And then that was what stayed and carried the whole thing forward. So I think I'm right about you having an appreciation of interconnectedness. Why do I think that? Because that is what contemporary technologies are about. They are about how you take the power of interconnectedness and build on it and use it and facilitate it. That's for sure. But we keep talking about it in this kind of flat language, social media, blah, 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 you know, all the rest, and the hype goes on and on and on. But underneath that is the capacity to to make connections, living connections, possible connections between people. So the mind, which is a lot of, as we know, very lively connections, that's one of the great extensions of this technology. But again, to what end? Well, that's up to us, isn't it? So, and then just have some great conversations, even if nothing happens, because they make you feel like a human, you know, that to recognize that your connection outside this terribly confined space of hype and financial exigency, you know, which one do you want? And how the hype is used as a way to say, as he said, how am I going to justify? What do you have to do with justifying what your institution is doing in the world? Apparently, you're the ones who somehow, you know, are going to make it all make sense. Good luck.
Your comments about the separation of administrative computing and academic computing made me think about the fact that our executive organization of our campuses are broken up into CFOs and CAOs and a very similar divide.
Right.
And so I'm going to ask you a provocative question, perhaps, and ask you your opinion on where do you think IT should report? Should it report to the president? Should it report to the CAO or the
whoever is the more terrific person? I mean it. You know, if you can do that, you know, of course you should make it sound like this, you know, this makes sense and all the rest.
I wanted to ask you a question because early on you mentioned something about this rhetoric that you were framing that's in the media about how technology will just automatically do X, Y, and Z. And you said that they state it as if stating it will make it so. And that made me think of Searle's theory of speech acts and the fact that there are many things that if you state them, they will be so. And
particularly if you're God, like let there be light.
Or, you know, I now pronounce you man and wife is the classic example, right? So I'm wondering if you have any thoughts for us, because I think most of the people in this room would be with you on the fact that we should focus on the what and not the how. How do we break into this media space mm-hmm. where there's this constant flood, and I worry about the Speech Act capability of this media to make it so, because they are repeating it often enough
Absolutely.
That it seems as though they're making it so.
Well, or at least they're making it true, seem to
right.
be true. Another easy question. Who made this speech to generate these questions? I think what you're making me think about is the media, actually. And it's making me think, you know, if you guys, and this would be planned and you'd really figure out how to organize the power behind it of your industry, so to speak, or your are actually very powerful. It has been made so, right? So if you were to decide there was an issue, if you could take an issue and the NIRCOM or whatever the big institutional umbrellas are, decides to make a statement about something, you would be heard. And particularly if you said what they're not, because you know, this is mind-numbing stuff. You know, they all can write their stories. There's a wonderful moment when Colbert show, he has the assistant mayor of San Francisco, and he's going on and on about how he uses technology and how he wants to talk to the people and on and on and on. You know it. All, you know, how you're going to use it, and bottom up and no top down. And Colbert finally does this thing where he says a series of absurd things, and he says, I can do that too. He's exactly right, you know, that talk. So suppose and so you know they know it at some level. If if there were some issues or an issue that the technology community wanted to make a statement about, or at least a substantial, you would get media attention, and particularly if it was not this drone, this hype. So the media for you, that's not true of most people will not get the attention of media. And certainly not if they're saying something thoughtful. That's really a problem. But you would. Does that make sense? Be skeptical. That's why the guys who aren't asking questions. They're skeptics, right? What can you do? I do believe that's the case, that you would get it. Now, that's part of the story. And of course, figuring out what the issue would be and how to organize that statement. But it does seem to me that, this business about, how everything's going to change, the thing, everything's going to change, of course, but now they're worried about money. So it's not technology is changing everything. It's that somehow the financial model isn't going to work. So somehow technology, you will see, will be called on to fix this. That might be an interesting issue to talk about. But I don't know. There are others, of course. That's just one thought, and I'm trying to avoid saying I don't know, but that would be something that I would think hard about, using the media. Let me give you an example of what I mean. If you want to have a story on education in the media, you could be doing amazing things, like this idea of a pedagogy of discovery rather than consumption. You can just imagine, right? New York Times is going to really run that one. But if you talk about an admissions story, you'll get it. If you do something about admissions, you can get a story. So one of the things you have to figure out is how do you get an admissions story something interesting? Because that will get anything it talks about, because everybody's worried about getting in. But technology is a hot button. And you guys are silent. Now, I'm not criticizing you, but you are. Everybody's talking about it. Your president's talking about it. Your vice president's talking about it. Your trustees are talking about it. You are silent.
Just out of curiosity, are we silent or are we not heard?
I don't know, actually. And that would be, I hope. Okay, I haven't heard. Can I ask you a question? Do you mind if you go back? What do you think? You would know better than I.
Depends on the institution, I would imagine. But I think often at the school that I'm from, and I'll not say here, I think often we're not heard. If we tell them something, no, I don't think that's the right way to do this, or we should look at other solutions.
When you tell whom?
In our case, we're under the provost. And they will not back us and go ahead and go off and buy another, product or another solution or look for another answer where they get the answer they want versus the answer we give them.
Right. Yeah. Well, when you're dealing with people who want something, it's tough. One of the things you want to keep trying to figure out is can you find a conversation or can you find people who matter where it's not totally shaped by what answer they want. And there are going to be some people. There just are. That may not be enough. But one of the things we all know is there's no point. One of the things you really want to do in this world is pick your fights. It serves no one for you to bang your head against a wall. It really doesn't. That's one thing. Another thing is not only do you want to pick your fights, you want to pick fights you can win. Because if you lose, what you're fighting for loses. And if you're fighting for something important, that matters. It doesn't if you're fighting for something stupid. Who cares whether you want to lose? But when you are really after something important, then you want to win. That's called ruthless. It's not. It's principled. And so you really want to think about strategic questions. And how do you penetrate this predictable, he said, then.
Although you certainly can answer this as well, I sort of want to ask a question of everybody else in here. because I know there's a lot of organizations where we do have already combined teaching, learning, and then technology included to try to address more than just the technology. But how many people in here feel that they have spoken up at their institutions about the tenure process in addressing teaching practices as being part of the tenure process and haven't really had that addressed? And not even to speak of what we're teaching, but just caring about how we're teaching. Because I know at least I'm in a research institution, so it's not a big thing. And just for us trying to get some kind of hearing to say, hey, can we make this a little bit more part of the process to care about instructors who care about teaching better?
Sure.
It's just not heard.
Yeah. One idea, I mean, I did give you, which is the embedded librarian. Now, that's a really interesting idea. And it's what you want to do, and there are a lot of reasons why it's interesting. One is it's interesting. What a thought. But the other is that it's kind of hard to just ignore that idea, that you could put into the room itself people who can facilitate. And so, you know, the whole idea, as you know, is you're in the library. And I'm talking about information technology in a broad sense. So you leave the classroom or wherever it is, and you go to the library and you bring them whatever it is that you're... But suppose you're in the room and you're watching what's going on. And so when somebody... And people see you, of course. And, I mean, something happens. And the very idea of it, like, oh, my God, a non-faculty person and a non-student in the room, my God, what does that mean? But it's hard to say no. Or at least it's hard not to talk about it a little bit. Or so that's a very clever... as well as, I think, a very interesting idea. And might even be welcomed by a lot of people, because why not? Great. You guys can do it. Now, one thing you don't want to find yourself saying is we don't have time. So that's all of our problem. That first, we don't, and secondly, we don't know how to fight that properly, and we don't know how to say, well, this really bad. Makes sense. Yes.